Hola, bienvenidos a La Ventana Latina.
You are listening to
The Latin Window.
BCFM 93.2.
Every Tuesday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon.
Spanglish or bilingual.
La Ventana Latina, la radio de Bristol.
Window to the world.
Está escuchando La Ventana Latina en el 93.2.
La radio de la comunidad de Bristol.
Los martes de 2 a 3 de la tarde.
BCFM Radio.
Your choice, your voice.
Number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Stop doing what the enemy wants you to do to divide us so we can be conquered. I believe in freedom for you and for every other person. I don't care what their race is. I don't care what their religion is. I don't care what their point of ancestral origin was. And until every American starts thinking like that, we're all going to be slaves. Enslaved by our own minds, our own stupidity, our own prejudices.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin Luther, Vladimir Lenin and Arthur Balfour. This week, the State of Israel, Russian Revolution and the Reformation conspiracy planets align. So we get different views this week on the notorious Balfour Declaration made at the height of the First World War and that led to the creation of the Israeli state, as well as a look at the Russian Revolution, started by Vladimir Lenin and his train journey from Basel in Switzerland to St. Petersburg. Also, 500 years ago this week in the German town of Wittenberg, Martin Luther is said to have nailed his claims against the Catholic Church to the door, which led to the Protestant Reformation and the Christian Church's second great schism after the break between the Orthodox Constantinople and Catholic Rome in 1154. On top of all that, our usual look at conflicts and underreported news around the world, such as the bomb dropped from a British jet, they think, on a marketplace in Yemen this week, which killed 30 people. Nearly four times the number who were killed when pedestrians were mown down in New York. Just compare the coverage of those two stories, folks. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, former Greenham campaigner Frances Leader tells us how her oil worker's husband's car was taken apart by MI5, who then interrogated him and tried and failed to turn him against his own wife. Also, former US Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett looks at Robert Mueller's 9/11 connection. He's the McCarthy-style guy going after Trump's friends in the US courts. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or, if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we have to start this week, Martin, I think, with the JFK files, which were being released pretty much as we were on air last week, last Friday. All sorts of interesting bits and pieces coming out, but none of them covered by the mainstream press, except the Daily Mirror, who mentioned at the top of their important points this guy, James Files. Also, some of the stuff that came out was quite fascinating. This photograph of George H.W. Bush in Dallas that day and a report by him, as well as another report saying that scores of journalists had been seconded by the CIA to write favourable stories to their point of view of the assassination.
Well, I have to admit, I haven't followed this very closely because I've just presumed for years that JFK was assassinated by a cabal within the US government, and the evidence of that is overwhelming and has been for years.
There's another thing that came out in the files was multiple shooters.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite clear that I think one of the things I did pick up was that the autopsy report said that the bullet came from a completely different direction than the book depository where Oswald was supposedly the assassin. And, you know, but what seems to happen is everybody kind of knows that JFK was assassinated by the state, but at the same time, everybody just you know, shrugs their shoulders and we all there's nothing to see here, folks.
Well, we did a program about it, didn't we?
Cognitive dissonance.
In 2013, we did a whole program about it, which was on the 50th anniversary, which you can find online if you look up, and I'll put a link to it on our show page, which really pointed, it's easy to remember how to find it. It's LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, CIA and the FBI that were involved in the conspiracy, because of course it's not just about killing the president, it's also about making sure that all of the agencies that might be charged with investigating them are in on it so that they can cover it up.
Yeah, you've forgotten the mafia, they were also involved, but they generally cooperate with the three agencies you've just mentioned.
The motive, what was the motive?
Well, there is some dispute about that. Variety of different motives. It's possibly that some people think it's because JFK was determined to get rid of the CIA. He said he was going to break it into 1,000 pieces. Some people think it was because he was not prepared to go along with the Vietnam War, and LBJ was. Others think it was to do with the Israelis not being happy with JFK's policy towards them, and they certainly had a finger in it, to my mind. There are various theories. Oh, and of course, the Bay of Pigs. He was, you know, he'd not supported the Castro, anti-Castro intervention. Well, he had supported, but he hadn't supported it sufficiently robustly.
Well, there were a lot of people
that
were involved in training for the Bay of Pigs, but then they blamed JFK, didn't they, for not providing air support, which meant that all the people they trained were dying or captured, and the whole thing was a failure.
In other words, there are multiple motives. So, you know, you've got means, motive and opportunity, and that's why he ends up dead. And, of course, don't forget, soon thereafter, within a few years, his brother Robert Kennedy was also killed, as was Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King, for example, a jury in a civil case in the US has already concluded that he was murdered by the state, effectively,
well,
by the FBI.
Best books on, I think, on the Kennedy assassination, I think one's called Last Word, which was written by Mark Lane, who was a lawyer friend of Kennedy's, who right from the very beginning was told by various people, including, I think her name is Madeleine Brown, Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend at the time, that there had been this meeting the night before where those conspirators that I mentioned, Lyndon Johnson, I think it was Hoover, wasn't it, from the FBI, and the former CIA boss Alan Dulles, or I think whoever was the current CIA boss, were meeting at a mansion. So he was told, Mark Lane was told, and very little of his work seems to have really been followed up. But more recently, in 2003, a Dutch journalist called Wim Dankbar discovered this guy, James Files, in prison over in the US, and went into prison to interview him. Now, he was a former soldier in the 82nd Airborne Division, and he'd actually been in live combat fights, which is how he's managed to survive, I think, to this day, because there were several attempts to assassinate him after the assassination of Kennedy, where he would sort of roll over in his car, grab a gun and start firing back at the people who were trying to kill him off. But James Files is a pretty convincing witness, and he's the one person, congratulations to the Mirror for, I think it was Fleet Street Fox that had it as the number one item, but one of the things, of course, they can't do on the Daily Mirror is let you hear James Files describe himself, his confession effectively of killing Kennedy. And so you can decide as the jury out there what you think of Files, and why isn't it that the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and all the rest of them and Sky haven't played this interview with Wim Dankbar. By Wim Dankbar with James Files, who was working as a hitman for the Chicago Mafia. And you quite rightly said, Martin, the Mafia were very much involved in this assassination. So let's have a listen now to just a brief description of the assassination from the person, it looks like, who may well have been the Grassy Knoll assassin.
And at that point, when they started proceeding down Elm Street, shots started being fired from behind. And I assumed that it was Mr. Nicoletti, because he is the one who was in the building, and I knew that Johnny Roselli was there. I remember the shots ringing out, and even though the president was being hit with the rounds, I was considering it a miss because I knew that we were going for a headshot on the president. And I had known he had been hit in the body, but I didn't know what part at that time. And I seen the body lurch, and I saw the body lurch again. I heard another shot that missed, and we were supposed to hit no one but Mr. Kennedy. And I guess Governor Cumley got hit with one of the rounds at that point. And I wasn't even sure of that because I was keeping Kennedy as best I could in the scope on the fireball. And when I got to the point where I thought it would be the last field of fire, I had zeroed in to the left side of the head there that I had, because if I waited any longer, then Jacqueline Kennedy would have been in the line of fire. and I'd been instructed for nothing to happen to her. At that moment, I figured this is my last chance for a shot, and he still had not been hit in the head. So as I fired that round, Mr. Nicoletti and I had fired approximately at the same time as the hit started forward, then it went backward. I would have to say that his shell struck approximately 1,000th of a second ahead of mine, maybe. That's what started pushing the head forward, which caused me to miss in the left eye, and I came in on the left side of the temple. At that point through the scope, I witnessed everything, matter and skull being blown out to the back of the limousine, and everyone on television watching saw Jackie Kennedy crawl out there to get it. I watched her hold on her hand to crawl back in the car and put the fireball back into the briefcase and close it up, and I'd pull my jacket off, reverse my jacket, so I would have, instead of a plaid side out, I would have the gray like a dress jacket, more or less. And I put a cap on my head, and I had to walk away carrying a briefcase.
So, Martin, what with all this publicity around JFK again, why have we just simply not heard this interview?
Well, as you say, the Daily Mirror have mentioned it. So, in other words, what tends to happen is, because, frankly, lots of more radically minded people have always assumed that Kennedy was assassinated, and the general population think that it's not terribly interesting because it happened 50 years ago.
Well, we heard actually on the day, I heard a report on the BBC saying that Lee Harvey Oswald had been for a meeting in Mexico City with some Russian assassins a few days before the assassination.
Yeah, but he's just the patsy. What you do with all of these attacks, you have the actual technicians who carry out the attack, like files that we've just heard, and there's other people who are set up to be the ones who are blamed. So that, you know, look at what happens with this truck attack in New York. The guy does it, and then he's immediately arrested, and there's immediately a story about everything to do with it. I'm very suspicious about that. There's a pattern to all of these things, and I think what people have got to realise is if you've got a deep state in the US which is prepared to assassinate the elected president in 1962, then they're quite capable of carrying out 9/11 decades later, and they obviously did. And it's very dangerous. We've got a creeping fascist police state developing in the United States of America, a state with the most nuclear weapons on the planet. It's far scarier than what happened in the 1930s in Germany, but we're still well asleep. People are sleepwalking.
Okay, what about the attack in Las Vegas then? Because that was one of the most recent and most horrific attacks in the United States.
Well, obviously, again, like all of these events, they're coming thick and fast now. And of course, if you live in Baghdad, loads of people have been killed in the last week in Afghanistan. It's in Syria.
We just heard also about this bomb in Yemen this week. A Saudi airstrike kills 29 people in the middle of a marketplace. Now, that's not a military target. And the British RAF are apparently helping with the targeting over
there. Indeed, they are. And if I was a Yemeni patriot, I might decide it's time to come to Britain and shoot some RAF personnel. I'm not saying that they should. I'm just saying that's the bottom line in warfare. It always has been.
So why do we hear, I'm going back to the files for a final time, I'm going to ask you again, why do we just simply not hear and not see this interview on our broadcast press here in the UK, even though he's by far the most convincing person who's confessed to actually killing Kennedy?
Well, if you look at Jonathan Friedland's piece in The Guardian of a couple of weeks ago, basically, those who work in the mainstream media, who want to have a career and a family and a mortgage, are basically told, or it's implied, that you are not to go down this road. Just ignore all of this. It's conspiracy theory. And of course, the term conspiracy theory was invented by the CIA in the aftermath of the JFK assassination, because various people were circulating what were called assassination theories. That's what they were called. And they said, no, we can't call them assassination theories. We need to rebrand this. We'll call them conspiracy theories. And that still runs even now. If you're in an academic seminar or you're talking to a mainstream journalist and you start talking about stuff like this, you go, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, which is meant to mean that you don't know what you're talking about. But of course, it's illogical and stupid. Of course there are conspiracies. The question is, what are they? The idea that there are no conspiracies is simply absurd.
Okay,
of course there are.
Is there any real implication for the assassination of John F. Kennedy today in the world?
Of course there is, because the deep state, Kennedy clearly was a threat to somebody, otherwise he wouldn't have been assassinated. Now, that I think that's a lesson to all sort of anarchists and others who say there's no point voting, no point participating in politics. If the deep state are prepared to kill the President of the United States, they've got a reason to getting rid of him. That doesn't doesn't mean he's perfect. It doesn't mean that he's a saviour. It doesn't mean that he's going to solve all of our problems. But if the deep state go around assassinating senior politicians, they've got a reason for doing it. And that is best because they want to control us and the world. And that's what's been happening ever since, is it not? That's exactly what's been happening.
Okay, let's move on. I mean, we've got quite a lot to talk about with the Reformation and Balfour and the rest of them. What are your thoughts about the 500 years since Martin Luther? Because this is, it will cause an enormous amount, centuries of discord. In fact, some would say it was one of the things that was behind the English Civil Wars as well, which was the dispute between the Protestants and the Catholics. So what do you think is the lesson to learn for today from that?
Well, somebody was brought up in the Church of England, we were always brought up to believe that this was a moment of truth for Christianity, and that Luther was a great guy, and that, you know, that basically he was a man of his times, but in many ways it was a necessary and you know, good thing for it to have happened, that he nailed the theses to the door. Although modern historians are not quite sure whether he even did that, but it doesn't really matter because, of course, the impact was the same whether he did it or not. But I think Luther was anti-Semitic openly. He supported the suppression of the peasants' uprising in Germany. He was a rather unpleasant character in many respects. But that doesn't detract from his historical importance, because obviously the importance of it was that Europe split into factions that basically hated each other so much that they led to the 30 Years' War and the English Civil War and so on and so forth.
Now, Brad Gregory has written a book about Luther about the 500-year split in the church, and he's entitled a piece he wrote this week in the NC Register. I think the C stands for Catholic, so it's a Catholic magazine of some sort. He's saying the unintended Reformation, how a religious revolution secularised society. Do you think that's true, that it led to a more secularisation of society?
Well, I think what's happened, once you've decided that you're not going to accept the authority of traditional hierarchies, then you start the process by which all hierarchies are questioned. So by there used to be just one church, then there were more than one, then there were lots, then people decided that they didn't have to necessarily believe in religion at all, and the process began there, and it's significant for that reason.
One of the important events was this thing called the Diet of Worms. I don't know how they managed to make that one up, but it's a diet is an assembly, yes, and Worms was a town in Germany. The yes. Diet of Worms was...
We used to laugh about that when I was doing my A-level.
which was about interrogating Martin Luther, and he was very worried about going because various previous people that had gone to these diets had been actually arrested, and some of them be killed.
Yeah, like Jan Hus.
Yeah, it does seem as if there was this kind of inquisition going on even at the time into him, and it was amazing that he managed to survive.
Well, he did, and many others didn't. Yes, I mean, the church was a persecuting church, and the Protestants, of course, when they rebelled against it, they ended up persecuting the Catholics and other Protestants, and, intolerance, that's probably the most toxic legacy of the Reformation, is the intolerance and extremism of attitude towards religion.
And what about the Puritans? They were doing effectively what ISIS were doing, going around smashing things up, weren't they?
They were, but they would say that they were justified as...
They did it for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, everybody thinks they're right, don't they? That's one of the problems.
And what about the key to what the Reformation was really all about, which was this whole thing of justification by faith or justification by works? Now, I'm not sure if those are just two polar opposites, but it certainly seems that just by saying, I've got faith, that doesn't necessarily... mean that you're a good person, because some people say, I mean, like Tony Blair, for example, you would always say that he was a perfect Reformation man.
Well, Luther's theology was derived from Saint Augustine, and he picked up from Saint Augustine of Hippo, that's right. He was basically saying that we are all sinful, so the whole idea that people are basically fundamentally sinful, and that therefore, it's only because God is good that we are saved. And it doesn't matter what you do, God, it's God's decision. God's
but it
beyond
does
God.
Matter. It does matter what you do, surely.
Well, that's what the Catholics would
argue.
It's
how you act, surely.
No.
Well, so what they were doing was saying that it doesn't matter what you know. Well, you can just say any old thing, and you'll go to heaven.
Well, in actual fact, what the Catholic Church traditionally said, that both works and faith were necessary, an Arminian Protestants like the Church of England also argued that works and faith were necessary. But the more extreme Protestants, the Calvinists and others, took the view that it was God's decision to save people. And he might decide to save Hitler and send you down to hell, because that's what God can do if he wants to, and it's his decision. Which, of course, is actually a defiance of what I would call the rationalist tradition, going back to Socrates and the ancient Greece.
Isn't that God's job to do it, not the Inquisition's job?
Well, that's what the Protestants would argue, because the Inquisition was the Catholic Church's mechanism for trying to keep people in line. But I would suggest that aspect of Reformation theology is in contrast to, as you said earlier, rational ideas about ethics. If what we do doesn't matter, then why don't we just do what we want? And of course, some extreme Protestant sects, the ranters, for example, in this country, took the view that therefore it didn't matter what we did. So they basically indulged themselves as much as they liked. They thought, well, God doesn't care what we do, because he's going to save us anyway, or he's not.
The actual effect here on the ground was massively increasing the power of Henry VIII, who went around smashing up all the monasteries. In fact, actually, they weren't actually smashed up, were they? They were just privatised, effectively, to some of the gentry. But I mean, and also, of course, his multiple wives, you know, having as many women as he wanted. That was the effect on the ground here.
Well, the multiple wives thing is he could have had any mistresses he wanted. He didn't actually have mistresses, Henry VIII. If he'd had a few mistresses, he wouldn't have had to keep changing his wives. The monasteries were literally asset stripped. They took everything from them and sold it, and then the money was given to the crown, and then the property was then sold on to various supporters of Henry VIII at a knockdown price. It was like, it's a bit like the privatisation in Russia in the 1990s, where an existing infrastructure is completely replaced by an even more predatory one.
There was really a fair amount of resistance from the clergy to this around the country. They wasn't there. They didn't really want to have all their monasteries closed down, the abbots and the rest of them.
Well, they wouldn't do, would they? I mean, the abbot of Glastonbury was hung, drawn and quartered on the top of Glastonbury Tor. And I remember walking up there once and seeing this little plaque saying, well, this is where the monarch of Glastonbury was hung, drawn and quartered. And I thought, I remember the line of poetry, I can't say, everything is beautiful and only man is vile.
His name was Richard Whiting. He was the abbot of Glastonbury, and he was really the last senior person in the monastic tradition that was resisting Henry VIII. And of course, as you said, Martin, he was killed for his trouble.
Wasn't just killed, hung, drawn, and quartered.
That's probably worse, is it? I don't know how much you're allowed to go into it, but tell us what that meant.
Well, you're basically hanging people doesn't happen quickly. If you string somebody up, it can take up to half an hour for them to die, and they don't. They get an erection. They poo themselves, they pee themselves, and then what you get very close to them dying, then you cut them down, then you cut off their private parts, and you open their stomach, and you burn their private parts and their stomach in front of them. They're still alive while all of this is going on, and then they're finally beheaded and chopped into four bits. It takes anything up to 2 or 3 hours.
That happened to the abbot of Glastonbury on the tour.
On the tour.
Well, there's the Reformation for you, Martin Luther.
Mm.
Not necessarily very pleasant. Do you know anything about the Pilgrimage of Grace? Because Luther was saying that grace was what it was all about. And we had something called the Pilgrimage of Grace here in Britain in 1536, which was a protest against the Protestants, effectively.
Yeah, it was led by people in the north and some, local elites and local people who basically, people were naturally conservative in this era. They generally didn't like change, especially religious change. So, there was certainly not majority support for Henry VIII's policy. Far from it. But he was very powerful, and he had the power of the state behind him. And eventually the Pilgrimage of Grace was crushed with many people suffering as a result.
Well, they were being, I suppose, a little bit cheeky, weren't they, calling it the Pilgrimage of Grace. Hey, you people who say that grace is all that matters, that's the Lutherans and the Calvinists and these people, we have our own form of it. But anyway, it's fascinating, I think, the way that it turned from a so-called reformation of the church into a massive, massive privatisation. And of course, the monasteries were providing services. They weren't just making money through wool and making, was it mead and things like this? They actually had their own infirmaries where local people could be looked after, things like that.
Yeah, the sort of basic social infrastructure was provided via monasteries. The other point, of course, that used to be argued was that the breakup of the monasteries helped to get capitalism off in Britain, because the business type minded supporters of Henry VIII who took over the lands of the monasteries used them more effectively and efficiently and basically started a capitalist way of thinking.
But in actual fact, the
monasteries had pioneered what we might call modern business methods hundreds of years previously.
So what was the Thatcher era in the 80s? Was there more privatisation then or under Henry VIII?
Well, I don't think it makes much sense to talk about these two eras in the same breath. They're very different social structures and a very different setup. So what you're talking about is transfers of power and wealth.
But still, it's social infrastructure going into private hands.
Yes, it is. But don't forget that the monasteries were not entirely owned. They were owned by who they were owned by. They weren't owned by individuals, but the church was pretty powerful. And the people at the top of the church lived a pretty good life, and at the expense of others, just as they do now.
Okay, let's I don't know if the church then was the same as now, but anyway, let's go forward 400 years and have a little look at the Balfour Declaration. And a couple of months ago, I spoke to he's actually a Swiss German blogger that's now living in the other side of the Iron Curtain, as I suppose the hawks in the United States would call it. He's in Abkhazia. Which is on the eastern coast of the Black Sea. And I was fascinated to hear his take on the Balfour Declaration, which his take on what the politics was around the First World War and the Second World War. And he's an ex-former Swiss banker.
The reason for the Second World War was the unresolved First World War. You see, we have to know why Germany lost the First World War, although there was never a single foreign soldier on German soil. How can you lose a war if there was no invasion? I mean, the British and the French and the Americans never went onto German soil in the First World War. Germans were saying, why the hell did we lose the war if there were no foreign troops in our country? You see, you have to know why Germany lost the war, although in 1917 they actually had won it already. You see, in 1917 Germany had won the war, the First World War. And they were talking with the Brits about a peace treaty. You see, the reason why Germany won the First World War in 1917, because they beat the Russians on the Eastern Front, and they could move all their troops from Russia over to the West Front. You see, first they beat the Russians, and then they had all the free soldiers coming over from the East to the West, fighting the Brits and the French. That means they had won the war. Yeah, now, what happened was, the Zionists in America were totally supporting the Germans because they were fighting the main enemy of the Zionists, which was the Tsar of Russia. Was the main enemy. So as long as Germany was fighting the Russians, they were supporting the German war, Americans.
So why was the Tsar of Russia so much hated by the Zionists?
He knows the ideology. He knew them, and they were, they were persecuted in Russia. So what happened was, when the Germans beat the Russians, this kind of freed up their support, and what happened was that the Zionists went then to the British government and said, we will help you to win the war. And the Brits said, what? We have lost. How can you help us win the war? And then they said, well, we can do it, but we want something from you. And the Brits said, well, you can have anything you want if you help us win the war. And then they said, well, we want Palestine because it's your territory, Palestine, because it was under British governorship at that time. the Brits, you know, beat the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, which were before governing Palestine. Now, what happened was is that the so-called Balfour Declaration was then signed between the British government and Lord Rothschild. This document exists. It is in the archive of the current Lord Rothschild in his huge palace that he has in England. I saw an interview where he showed it a few months ago as a kind of anniversary of this Balfour Declaration, which was written up by Lord Balfour. Now, this declaration says that the British government will support that the Zionists will get Palestine. And this is how the whole Israel business started. It was 1917. What the Zionists then did, because they controlled all the media in America, is that from one day to the other, they completely changed their support from pro-German into anti-German. And then the thing with the Lusitania happened, which was an absolute provocation, because everybody knew that there were gun runners and moving weapons and ammunition on a civilian ship, passenger ship, from America to Britain. And Churchill was involved, and he let this passenger ship go into an area where it was known that the German U-boats were sitting in wait without any protection, and that's how that ship got sunk in before the coast of Ireland, and 1,000 passengers died. And, of course, that was a huge propaganda thing against the Germans, that they sunk this passenger ship. Although the German government put up in the New York Times, in other New York newspapers, warning passengers not to go on board because it was a gun-running ship, and therefore a legitimate target in wartime.
Well, I heard with interest what your contributor
Manfred
there is saying.
Petrich, yeah. He runs something called the Smoke and Mirrors blog in German.
Yeah, I mean, I think much of what he says is true, but at the same time, I think he's over-exaggerating the role of the Zionists. They weren't actually that powerful at that stage. The British thought they were, but they weren't as powerful as they thought they were. I mean, the British were deluded in their belief that the Zionists had a great deal of influence in the Jewish community. They didn't really. Lord Rothschild did, but Lord Rothschild was a very powerful individual. Jews in general were not Zionists at that period. And in fact, there was a member of the British government whose name
I'm just thinking because hang on, Theodor Herzl and his World Zionist Congress was quite big, and that had been going
since 1897. Yeah. So it had been going for 10 years or so, but in actual fact, most Jews around the world were not Zionists then, and I dare say most Jews around the world aren't Zionists now.
That's nearly 20 years, isn't it?
Yes, I know, but the point is that the Zionists were an extreme faction within world Jewry. They were not a majority by any stretch of the imagination, and what they did is they were very good at manipulating the situation to their own advantage, but the idea that Jews in general were Zionists is simply wrong. They weren't.
Well, it's probably the same for many now, actually.
I think that's right.
And let's have a listen now to Edwin Black. He's very much more pro-Zionist, and he's Jewish himself. He's a Jewish author, has written several books. One's called The Transfer Agreement, which is about the agreement between the Zionists and Nazi Germany, and another one is called IBM and the Holocaust, which is between the American IBM Corporation and the Nazi Gestapo. But anyway, here he is talking about Theodor Herzl's many Balfour declarations, because there wasn't just one.
The very first of these Balfour declarations was the French declaration by Foreign Minister Jules Caban, and that was actually months before the Balfour Declaration on November 2nd, 1917. Of course, you had the Bolshevik Revolution, which was just days before the Balfour Declaration. Woodrow Wilson personally approved the draft of the Balfour Declaration. There were many drafts, many revisions, many hopes to make a revision, but ultimately, Britain could not reverse the Balfour Declaration, because the Balfour Declaration represented all the leading democracies, were written into the treaties and approved by 52 nations. So Woodrow Wilson approved it October 1917. The Balfour Declaration was actually issued on November 2nd of 1917. Within a month, the Turkish Pasha also reluctantly accepted the Balfour Declaration and offered to make a Jewish homeland. The Germans, who were also fighting the war on January 5th, 1918, issued their own Balfour Declaration. Remember, there were Zionists in every country. There was Zionists in America, in France, in Turkey, in Germany, in Palestine. And all these people were working diplomatically so they could fulfill Herzl's dream, was to have a legal country that came about legally under international auspices.
So, Martin, did you know there were so many different declarations around the world? The Zionists were very well organised.
There were, but I mean, obviously, we're remembering the particular one that was signed in Britain on November the 2nd, because that's the anniversary that we're talking about. And, of course, it wasn't the only factor leading to the creation of the State of Israel. It's one of the factors.
Also, that the Ottomans were expelling the Jews, apparently, as well, from Palestine.
Well, they weren't in charge at that
stage. Most people don't understand that in 1914 and 1915, 16,000 Jews at Passover were rounded up and expelled from Jewish Palestine instead of being exterminated. So when they came back, they didn't come back from 2,000 years ago. They didn't even come back from 2,000 days ago. They came back from 1 or 2 years before. Obviously, when the UN Charter was written up, there was no finality in the determination of Jewish Palestine and its Arab neighbors. But in Article 80 of the UN Charter, it said all the documents that had preceded in international negotiations, and that would include the Balfour Declaration, the mandate for Jewish Palestine, the Treaty of Lausanne, the Treaty of Sèvres, all of these different documents, San Remo, were valid and were not to be compromised and were to be decided by the people. All of you know that UN Resolution 181 gave yet another opportunity for the Arabs to form their own state, to make yet another state, and the Jews would have this little triangle. The Jews said yes, the Arabs said no. They continued to legally purchase property, and then the whole effort was, how do we undo the legal purchase of property that has taken place because Jews have legally bought property? That's all that I'm going to talk about for now, because I think there are other Congress people are either here or on their way. But while we're waiting for them, does anyone have a question about the Balfour Declaration and why this was not a gift as much to the Jews as to all mankind to finally put democracy in the Middle East? There had been no democracy in the Middle East for 500 years. The Jews got national rights, and everybody else got civil rights, equal rights.
Well, that's the U.S. Jewish Zionist author Edwin Black speaking in Washington last week, Martin.
Last week? Well, I mean, the idea that the State of Israel created democracy in the Middle East is, I think, pretty laughable.
Well, why? Because it is the only democracy, proper democracy in the Middle East.
Oh, I think Iran has got a much more robust democracy than Israel. Half the population in Israel.
Yeah, but it hasn't got a proper democracy. It's got a theological democracy, a theocracy.
Right. I'm not going to argue about whether... The very point...
Well, why can't you just address his argument head on there? I mean, he's saying that Israel
is
the only
democracy.
Is only proper democracy in the Middle East.
It's not true. It's not a proper democracy. Don't forget, they're in occupation of large chunks of land where people have no votes and no rights at all. 20% of the population of Israel is Arab and they're second-class citizens. And, of course, Israel has been involved in wars in Lebanon that kill thousands and thousands of people. How democratic is that? Is Lebanon part of Israel? No, it's not. But they've invaded it and killed loads of people there. Is that democratic?
Well, that's like, well,
not democratic for the Lebanese, is it?
No, but anyway, he's saying that it has actually been a positive influence, anyhow.
Well, I think that's extremely tendentious, isn't it? The idea that Western oriented settlers arriving in the Middle East bring modernity and freedom, and these benighted people they were just living in the Middle Ages until we turned up and made them into made the modern state of Israel. I mean, that's just basically racist gobbledygook, frankly.
What about Netanyahu's cabinet? Because I must admit, not many of those, most of them, in fact, particularly the key central people, seem to be white Europeans. They don't seem to be from that part of the world.
Well, you've got the split in Israeli politics between the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardic Jews. The Sephardic Jews tend to come from Arab countries like Morocco and so on. The Ashkenazi Jews came from Europe. And, of course, there's even some modern geneticists who believe that the Ashkenazi Jews are actually descended from the Khazars, who were a Turkic people based in what is now Crimea.
Didn't the BBC do a programme about
it? They did. There was a BBC Two programme about it, but the Israeli embassy objected so strongly to the programme being shown. I think it was a Horizon programme that it was never shown. But I think those who know about these things know that in actual fact the genetic basis of Ashkenazi Jews is somewhat dubious. But I mean, we've got to separate now between Zionist politics and Jewish people. There are two completely different things, and the Jewish religion.
There is an attempt to conflate the two.
The Zionists always try to conflate the two, but it's not necessarily a justifiable thing to do.
Also, we've had Benjamin Netanyahu in London this week to celebrate the Balfour Declaration and chatting with Theresa May about Iran, according to the Jerusalem Post. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But she is saying that the British people feel, telling him and the rest of the world, that the British people feel pride in the Balfour Declaration.
Well, clearly the Tory establishment in this country do feel pride in it. Why, on the anniversary of Mohammed Abbas, the not really elected leader of the Palestinians, because Hamas won the last election in Palestine, he wrote in The Guardian today saying, well, where was my invite? Because we were promised in the Balfour Declaration that we were going to get our rights respected by the British, but they weren't. And, of course, there's going to be a demonstration in London tomorrow about exactly that.
Okay, so what do you think is the legacy now with this Balfour Declaration? Is it is there any kind of balance, do you think, that was intended in the original
No, I mean, you document? Can't... It wasn't... don't forget, this was still the time of empires. So the British, because they'd conquered Palestine, thought it was theirs to dispose of to anybody they wanted. Now, in actual fact, that's just not the case. The local inhabitants had an absolute right... To the society and infrastructure that they created over hundreds of years. The British have no right to hand it to anybody else under any circumstances whatsoever. And there really is a question whether the state of Israel should be allowed to exist. And by that I don't mean that the Jews that are living there shall have to move. There is a real question, Mark, as we go into 2018, whether the state of Israel should have a seat at the United Nations and should be recognised as an independent state. Catalonia isn't going to get a seat at the United Nations. Why have the Israelis got one when in actual fact they don't play by the rules? There's hundreds of resolutions being passed in the United Nations against the state of Israel. They've ignored them all, including the right of return of people who've been kicked out, and if they won't accept them, you just de-recognise them.
I mean, isn't there just a basic problem here in that there is not going to be a balance between Arab and Jewish Israel? I mean, for example, Jerusalem as the capital is supposed to be, East Jerusalem is supposed to be Arab, and in fact the 67 war 50 years ago the Arab armies were kicked out by the Israelis.
Well, when Israel was recognised in 1948, Jerusalem was not part of the state as recognised by the United Nations. And when they say that Jerusalem is part of Israel, not according to international law it isn't, any more than Hong Kong is part of Britain or the Falklands are part of Argentina. That's the reality. And of course what the Israelis have done is they've managed to kid everybody that when they carry out aggressive attacks like Serbs do, like others have done in the past, that they're allowed to keep their gains. Now in actual fact that's a principle that we can't allow to be established. It's like the invasion of Sudetenland by Germany. We can't allow borders to be changed by force.
Like Crimea.
Because there was a referendum there and the people voted for it. Whereas the Israelis just went in mob-handed and took what they wanted.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Okay, on to the parallel 100 years, and that is the trip by Bolshevik leader Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who was living in exile in Switzerland when the first revolution took place, and then got on a train up to St. Petersburg and started the Russian Revolution. Now, Winston Churchill said of the journey, they transported Lenin in a sealed truck like a plague bacillus from Switzerland into Russia.
Well, yes, Churchill did say that, and the German high command basically facilitated Lenin and his colleagues going to Russia because they wanted him to run a revolution which would take Russia out of the First World War. But that actually probably is what allowed him to come to power, because the Kerensky government, the provisional government, wouldn't stop the war. They carried on fighting the war. And at that point, the population and the army were prepared to some extent to support the Bolsheviks to end the war.
So there was,
and of course, sadly, it then led to a civil war in which more people died than in the first World War.
Well, there was a 4-year civil war between the White Army and the Bolshevik Red Army. So who were these two factions?
Well, the White Army represented the previous regime and its acolytes, and they were supported by the British, by the Americans, and by the Western powers. So when the Russians get paranoid about the West, it's because they've been invaded. I mean, if the provisional government had taken Russia out of the First World War, and if they had address the demands of the ordinary people, perhaps there wouldn't have been a Bolshevik revolution, but there was.
Was it particularly nasty? Because there was the Cheka secret police were instituted as well, who were particularly notorious as being very ruthless.
Well, look, there's a huge literature and a huge set of arguments about what the Russian Revolution represented, and no doubt we'll be continuing to debate this in 100 years' time. But the Bolshevik Revolution, to my mind, was essentially a coup d'etat in the major cities. They didn't really have a lot of support in the countryside. The countryside was dominated by the Socialist Revolutionary Party, who were non-Marxist socialists. And when, in 1918, the elections to the Constituent Assembly took place from all over Russia, the Socialist Revolutionaries were the winners, because the peasants were 80 to 90% of the population. But the Bolsheviks represented a sort of intellectual elite plus the factory workers, and they controlled the towns, which is basically where, you know, modern societies are controlled from. And so the peasant interest was not represented. And I think that was a great tragedy for Russia.
OK, let's look around some of the other stories this week, which aren't necessarily related to what we've been discussing there. An Amnesty chair in Turkey has been kept in jail. Now, this is Amnesty International's Turkey chair, amongst others, who were arrested earlier this year, I think it was in May, when they were doing something called a crypto party. And if you go online and look up crypto parties, they're organised by various people from civil liberties campaigners, etc., to enable anyone, including journalists, to communicate on their laptops using email, on the internet, etc., without it being trackable. So That's a perfectly legitimate thing, surely, for Amnesty to be doing over in Turkey. But the chair of Amnesty is under arrest.
Well, Turkey is becoming an increasingly authoritarian regime. But you've got to understand that the Western powers attempted to overthrow the democratically elected government of Turkey not that long ago, and hundreds of people died. They're in a pretty paranoid state, the regime, at the minute, and I don't support the Turkish regime for a minute, and they shouldn't be locking people up. But you've got to understand why they're paranoid.
Also, we've had President Xi this week making even more changes to the law. In Hong Kong, for example, it's now imprisonable up to 3 years to ridicule the Chinese national anthem. I almost feel like if I could find it, a copy of the Chinese national anthem now and laughing at it, because you can be jailed for several years now in China for doing that. Also, something that happened last week was this whole thing of the declaration that President Xi is infallible, and that if you say he's not, then again you can be criminalised. It does sound as if he's moving down an extremely authoritarian route, Martin.
Well, I wouldn't say that China was a democratic society, but it's a relatively successful society, and a lot of people...
certainly couldn't say the sort of things we say in China. They'd have the secret police around within minutes.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't say them in Saudi Arabia either. In China, though, they've actually the ordinary people actually have a reasonable standard of living and some means of redress.
So they don't need freedom of speech, then?
They do. They do. They need it in Saudi Arabia
as well.
But what about,
I mean, the idea of being infallible is ridiculous. This is medieval, the Pope, something like that.
No, well, what's actually happened, the politics of this, is that Xi Jinping is the biggest, most powerful leader in China since Mao Zedong. That's what all the geopolitical analysis suggests. And he is going to be running the show from here on in. And he's got rid of all of his rivals. He's definitely the man in charge. And it's not a free society in our sense, but I think you will find that the majority of Chinese do support the regime and do support what it's done because it's improved their living standards. They're not happy with every aspect of it, but it's not an entirely... A society that's run entirely on fear and as it was in Mao's era. I mean, Xi Jinping has led the country and the right wing of the Chinese Communist Party have led the country in a much more positive and constructive direction than Mao was leading them in the 1970s.
Also,
and people appreciate that.
Also worth mentioning that the blogger Craig Murray, who's been on this show in the past, is in a libel trial beginning next week in London, being sued just simply for telling the truth, which is horrific sort of thing to see in this country, where he's just been basically taken out and taken down. Let's hope he wins his case. He's put out some crowdfunding for it. So we'll be following that on this show. But I thought we'd finish this week, Martin, with... I suppose this is aimed a bit at the Labour Party, because we've still got Ken Livingstone languishing and has been suspended. He's one of the probably the most great grandees of the party, just simply for telling the truth about the deals done, as we were hearing from Edwin Black's book earlier, between the Nazis and the Zionists.
Well, that's right. And of course, as we know from...
This is one of the legacies of Balfour, isn't it?
Yes, as we know from the Al Jazeera sting on the Israeli embassy, £1 million has been spent inside the British Labour Party to steer our politics. Talk about Russians winning elections, fixing elections. £1 million inside the Labour Party. And of course, Priti Patel has been in Israel this week having meetings with Israeli officials, even though she's breaking Foreign Office rules.
I mean, it's interesting that we've had the new Foreign Secretary on the day that Netanyahu visits London, who is the guy who was behind the sex scandal dossier, and he's suddenly been he's not been a minister before, but he's suddenly been made defence secretary.
Well, I think Netanyahu should not have been invited to Britain for the Balfour Declaration, and unless you're going to invite these Palestinians as well, it's probably better to ignore it. But of course, the Tory party is in the pocket of the Israeli lobby.
OK, so let's finish now with listening to... this is actually the former Israeli Education Minister, Shulamit Aloni, speaking to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! In 2002 about anti-Semitism.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money, and the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay. They are talented people, and they have power, money, and media, and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic, and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
Well, you heard it from the horse's mouth. That's what they do. They call people anti-Semitic if they criticize Israeli policy.
Okay, that's time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. It's coming up live on Facebook. It's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Bukhari. I just saw him poke his nose around the door, so he's definitely here tonight. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Green Councillor for Clifton Down, Carla Denyer, former teacher and founder, member of the Counter Colson Group, Christine Townsend and Dr. Roger Ball from Bristol Radical History Group. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing, enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Actually, that's a Chinese national anthem. I'll leave you with that and we'll have a laugh. Ha 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 ha! So you're going to build an underground, are you? For us? Hinkley in a deep water port. So that was not Sophie Ellis-Bextor, obviously. That was the Chinese national anthem. You're all supposed to stand to attention and salute as you see it. We're looking, apparently we're begging indeed for Chinese money for the Deepwater Port here in Bristol, for an underground, which I'm not sure if it's ever going to happen, which Marvin Rees, the mayor, talked about, and also for Hinkley C Power Station, which also might never happen. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. See you next week.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.